Well, get ready for this trip tonight. 3 hours with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. This is a very powerful and detailed interview concerning an entire story about a United States Air Force flight surgeon who was in the surgery room during one of the autopsies on an extraterrestrial biological entity in the late 1940s. Linda's done a lot of work about this story. She will share it with us all next on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, author. She goes directly to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges, first-hand eyewitnesses of high strangeness. Her website is earthfiles.com. She's a graduate of Stanford University, master's degree in communications, and she has devoted her documentary, film, television, radio career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment. And she's been working on just an incredible story. Hi, Linda. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi, George.
Good to hear from you. You've been traveling lately?
Well, yes, I have, and this story comes out of my appeals on Coast and Earth Files and Dreamland, going all the way back to December, January, February. Remember when I began saying on the air that if there were people in military and intelligence or new people who had firsthand experience concerning the extraterrestrial biological entity story, to get in touch with me, because it's very clear that this administration not only has a policy of denial, but wants to erase all information that there is. I was back at the National Archives in January doing research with some colleagues, and almost all the files that I had gone back to search and that had been released during the Clinton administration had all been reclassified. And so we are in a very difficult time in trying to get a fact and truth. And it was after those appeals on the air and at Earth Files that on April 24th, I received an email from a central Ohio businessman named Ronald Sequoy.
Okay.
He is 59 years old, and he got a bachelor's degree in clinical psychology from Ohio University. But he's worked in a variety of businesses ranging from restaurants to retail since he graduated. He is a family man with three children, and he considers himself a devout Christian. He has asked that his home city and company's name be withheld for protection, as well as the name of the flight surgeon that he is going to discuss in this 3 hours or 2 hours that we're going to unfold this story tonight, to protect that man's family.
All right.
Now, his first email stated, quote, "I used to work for a man in Dayton, Ohio, retired U.S. Air Force flight surgeon, who in a moment of great stress and emotional breakdown told me he was one of five military doctors called in to look at two alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Base," unquote.
Wow.
Now, last month in June, I emailed Mr. Sequoy and asked for more information. And he wrote back, quote, "He," meaning the flight surgeon, mm-hmm. "lived in Dayton always. He was the flight surgeon for an entire SAC wing. He did not tell me precisely when this occurred, just that it happened in the late 1940s near the time of Roswell. He said how he got phoned while sleeping, had to rush out to the base. The three generals were there, three, what he had to sign, threats made, the five doctors were involved. Only two doctors actually touched the body. The one alien was dead but showed no injuries. One was burned and had a horrible hole in one leg with an anguished look locked upon its face in death. He was a devout Catholic, and this had destroyed his belief system. He was furious at the government for involving him and for ruining his life and threatening him. He was terrified of the government, and he made me swear never to tell anyone. So for years, I never really did tell people the story. But to the best of my knowledge, he's gone. and I think the public deserves to know, unquote. Now, on June 27th, with his permission, Ronald Sequoy and I talked by phone in a two-hour recorded interview. And tonight on Coast, I would like to share segments of that interview over the next 2 hours and then take phone calls in the third hour. And I hope that there might be listeners who have their own firsthand Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or other military base experiences which you can or will share with me on or off the record. My email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. My news website, which contains a large real X-Files section and this report tonight in its entirety, is at www.earthfiles.com. Now, the date that the flight surgeon talked to Ronald Sequoy began in Christmas time of 1975 and continued through five in-depth conversations over the next several weeks. The older retired Air Force colonel and flight surgeon had formed a father and son relationship with Ronnie Sequoy, who was working as a manager in the older man's company. The extraterrestrial autopsy described was in the late 1940s at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. Here now is Ronald Sequoy with the story.
Listen closely.
One day I probed him on that subject about what were the things in the military that had caused so much stress for you, and to my utter surprise, he broke down and started crying. And I thought, my goodness, this man must have really been through some military campaigns that had really affected him. And he told me, I can't tell you. You wouldn't understand. And then one day he called me on the phone and said, I'd like to spend some more time with you, but instead of just an hour or so, on your day off, could you have lunch with me? And I said, sure. And he goes, and I'll pay you for it. And I said, well, you don't have to do that. And he said, that's all right. I'll give you half day pay. Well, I realized why when we got together for this luncheon. It didn't last an hour or so. We were together 2 or 3 hours. And one of the things he entered into was religious belief. And if I believed in God. And I said, very much so. He was out of a Catholic background, he said, and I was out of a Methodist background. And he really was probing why I believed in God. And I asked him, well, do you believe in God? And this look came over his face that haunted me, because I really liked this man, and the subject seemed to shatter him talking about it. And that's all we talked about was God and do you believe in the Bible and that sort of thing. And I thought, gee, this is such an odd series of conversations to be having with him. I wonder what's causing this.
But what was the look that came over his face when you asked him if he believed in God?
His whole countenance changed. This very handsome, together, very formal, aristocratic man, everything melted in his face, as if he was terrified, and his hands would shake. And I'm going, what experience caused this that he would shake? And the whole concept of talking about a God, and if God was real, why was he doing this with me? It almost frightened me, because, you know, it's my boss I'm talking with, and you know, you're always warned, don't get too personal with the person you're employed with, or that can end up to haunt you and you lose your job. And I like my job. So I said, did something happen in the military to break your religious beliefs or your belief in God? And he broke down. He began to cry in this public restaurant over in a corner, the worst cry I'd ever seen in my life. I decided right then and there that my fate that I had, whether it cost me my job or not, I had to figure out what was doing this to this man, why he was so broken down about this subject, what did he experience in the military. And again, I'm assuming it was the death of people, that it was warfare, that maybe people that he saw die. So I started probing him on that subject, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, I cannot tell you. I have restrictions. It's something I absolutely can't talk about. It has to do with national security. And that caught me by surprise. I said, you mean like secrets or something? And he said, absolutely like secrets. Things that I'm sworn under oath I can't ever divulge. And the meeting broke up on that note when we started talking about that subject, and that he was under oath he couldn't ever talk about what was disturbing him. It wasn't like he was asked. That was such a big top secret deal that he couldn't talk about it now. I didn't understand that, particularly for some. someone that was not like a command officer or something. He was a flight surgeon. What would a doctor in the military have that was so secretive that he couldn't talk about it years later? And on this next time we got together, when he drove up to where I was and walked in, I saw a total, complete countenance change on him. When he came in, I saw the colonel. He came walking in like a military man. And when he sat down, he said, "We need to talk." I said, "Yes, sir." It went through my head. He's back in the military. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's going to relate this subject to me that happened to him. The next few minutes, he talked about top secret type things, that when you give an oath in the military, you can't divulge things. And I said, "These many years later, were these combat things?" And he said, "No, sir. I told you before, it wasn't combat." But this kind of gut-wrenching problem that affects someone sure looks like death to me. And this look came over his face, and he said, "Yeah, it had to do with death." Death of men under your command? No, but death. But what could it be? And then he broke down. He said, "If I told you something, would you absolutely give me your word that you would never tell a living soul on earth?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "You couldn't tell your wife." "Okay, I won't tell my wife. You'll have to absolutely swear to me. I mean, you're a religious man. Will you swear on God's name?" I said, "I can't do that because it's against my religious beliefs." And then this look came over and he said, "I understand that." When I was in the military, he said, I was a doctor. I was in charge of a wing in SAC. All the military records and making sure the pilots were tested out about fatigue and all their problems about medical conditions. And I said, "Then you say you're a flight surgeon. Were you a surgeon?" He said, No. I'm a doctor, but I was more an administrative officer of doctors under me and all the records and everything." And I said, "Does this thing have to do with your job as a flight surgeon?" And he said, "Very much so." He said one night he got a call from the base at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And he was told he had to get to the base real soon. And he told the person on the phone that he would be there in about 2 hours. And a general came on the line. And a general, he didn't know who it was. And he was given a direct order to be at the base in 45 minutes. And so he had to scramble, and he realized he couldn't go casual, and he put on his uniform and jumped in his car. And then when he got there, another anomalous thing happened. Normally he would just go through and just drive onto the base through the checkpoint. And he had a sticker on his car, and of course the people at the guard post would know who he was. And there was a vehicle waiting for him, and he was told to follow it, and he was escorted onto the base. He wondered, are we in an alert, or has there been a plane crash, or what's going on? Because this had never happened to him before, he said.
And what year do you think this was?
Later, that very subject came up. He did not say the exact year, but he said in the very late 1940s. And I realized that one of the things he was doing here was trying to figure out how to regain his faith, that he admired the fact that I was a grown man and that I had religious beliefs, and it showed. So anyway, instead of going to the big administrative end of the base, which was the only place he ever worked, they went clear across the base to another area, to a series of buildings that he had never even been in. He was ushered inside by military police with an escort, and he went, "What is this?" And he began to have fear, because that was back in the era of the Cold War, that perhaps something wrong had happened in the world, and perhaps we were in some kind of alert. And when he went inside, he was met by a general that he had never met before. He didn't give me any names. He was taken into a side room, and when he went in the room, the general closed the door and said, "Sit down." He sat down at a table. The general sat down across from him, and he was expecting an explanation of what this was all about. And instead of an explanation, the general slid a piece of paper across the table at him and said, "Read that." And he looked at it, and it was a kind of form he had never seen before. And it had to do with security, and it was about a level of security clearance he had never heard of before. And he turned it over, and he said, "What do you want me to do with this?" And he said, "I want you to sign it." And he signed the thing. He said, "Why did I have to sign this?" And he said, "Because you're just about to enter into another level of military experience that you're not familiar with, and a certain level of keeping secrets that requires this level, and I have to warn you about something." What followed was threats. All his time in the military, he had always been treated with the most respect, and the fact that he was a colonel, he was really put off his psychology, that suddenly here's a colonel having him sign a special high-level top-secret form, And then he's being told that what you see here, what you hear here, you can't ever take off this base. And you can't ever talk about it to anybody unless you're addressed by your superiors. And that what you're about to go through, you have to only talk about with your superiors and with no other members of the military, nobody below you, nobody in the medical end of all the people that he dealt with on a daily basis. He couldn't discuss it with them. He could only discuss it when it was brought up by his superiors, and he could never take it off base. He couldn't talk to his priest. He couldn't talk to his wife. He couldn't talk to anybody about it. And that if he ever was found out that he discussed what was about to happen with anybody, it could end up destroying his military career and could even end up in court-martial. And before he could say anything or ask any questions, he said they immediately were walking up a hall. And his head was swimming by all this. What can this possibly be that I'm having to enter into a whole new world here of relationship with the military? And before he could get an answer, somebody walked up to him, handed him a clipboard, and on it was a notepad, and they handed him a mask. And he said, what's this for? And he said, just put it on. And when he walked around the corner, there were two more generals, one that he knew from the base and another general he did not know. And now he was really terrified because he's in the presence of three command structure generals. That never happened in his life that he was in that kind of position. And before he could ask any questions, he was walking up a hall towards a door, and there was a window in the wall that you could look into the next room. And inside, there was like lights set up. And he saw a photographer. Again, he thought through his mind, a crash, because they were taking pictures inside, and it just went through his mind, they've got bodies here. And the door opened, and he was told to walk in. And when he got inside, he just froze. And he said his whole world turned upside down by what he saw when he went through the door.
And in this next half hour, George, we will hear in great detail, it's the first time I have felt like perhaps through this flight surgeon and Ronnie Sikoy, that I am seeing what actually happened in at least one of the autopsies of an extraterrestrial biological entity creature at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in sometime from 1947 onward. And there will be much to talk about as we keep evolving this story through the next 2 to 3 hours. And as we come to the end of each audio, George, we can have some information update, and you can ask questions. But in this next segment, this is where this flight surgeon is ordered by these three generals to observe the autopsy of something that there's no words, no explanation. Imagine this, being yanked out of bed, a colonel at Wright-Patterson, three generals tell you, take a notebook, take a pad, write down what you see. And that is what happened to this man.
Linda, this has got to be one of the most riveting stories I have ever heard.
Oh, I thought so too. And wait till you hear how it continues to unfold.
And you picked this up during one of your appearances on Coast to Coast. Somebody called here?
Well, it's hard to know whether it's Earth Files, Coast, Dreamland, because I started in December and January putting out that appeal on Coast and at Earth Files and at Dreamland, asking if people had firsthand experiences. And I have now over 200 really substantive emails. The problem is the vast majority say, I cannot. I will not go on the record, but I want you to have this information.
Yeah, they're still scared. All right, stay with us, Linda. I'm looking forward to the next segment. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. Like Linda said, 2 hours of this, and then the last hour we're opening up the phone lines, you and Linda Moulton Howe. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe with now part two of four parts on this very remarkable story. And I got to tell you again, Linda, even the guys in the studio just were glued to the speakers during that last interview segment.
Right, and that's how I felt on the telephone. And right now, where we left off is that he has these three generals. They are taking him down a hallway. He has no idea where he's headed. And now, let's move on with the story.
He wasn't given any preparation for it. No one said anything to him. Nobody warned him about what he was about to see. He was just told, go in and stay along the wall, that there were other doctors in the room. And from your scientific expertise, being a medical doctor, observe, and anything that comes to your mind, take notes. When he asked, what do you mean by that? This one general told him, it'll be self-explanatory. And when he walked in, he saw that there was an autopsy going on, that there were two medical doctors dressed up in garb, they had a body on a table, and that there was lights on this, and that there was camera equipment, both motion picture and a man taking still photography, and that there were two other men along the wall that he later found out all five of them were doctors, and that one room they were all military doctors. There were two tables side by side, and on the two tables were two dead alien beings. He said that his whole world shattered that day, and he began to cry as he related the rest of the story. And his hands were shaking, and every once in a while, he would stop and tell him the story and revert back to, I don't know why this happened to me. He said that one of these alien beings looked perfectly normal, that you didn't see anything wrong with it, but it was obviously dead. But the alien being on the table next to it was just the opposite. It was horribly burned, had a horrific wound in one of its legs, but the look on its face, he couldn't forget it, was the look of anguished horror at the moment of its death, and it was frozen on this being's face. The autopsy was already going on. He couldn't say anything to anybody. He was just frozen in silence. He said the stench was unbelievable and that he was overcome by the situation and wanted to vomit, but he knew he couldn't. He wanted to run out of the room, but he knew he couldn't. And that for the first several minutes that he was in the room, that he just was transfixed, staring at what was going on, and wasn't writing anything. And then he remembered the directive he was given, write. Anything that comes to your head, write it down. So he said, with almost not looking at the paper, just staring at what was going on, anything that came to his head, he wrote it down on the paper. He said that these were obviously living creatures, but unlike any kind of living creature that he'd ever seen before, he said it was like they weren't real, like they were dolls or something. And I said, I don't understand what that means. And he said, they just didn't have the appearance of being weathered. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. He said, well, look at your skin. Think about living creatures. They're not pristine. They don't look like a doll sitting on a shelf. These creatures didn't have any signs of age. I said, you talking wrinkles? He said, exactly. They didn't look like they were wrinkled. They looked like big, huge, 4-foot dolls. They were not powerful beings. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, strong. They didn't have big shoulders. They had real slender arms. They were not powerful at all. Slim fingers and just small frame. They were not big. These were just little creatures. And the first thing about them that he noticed right away was when they were looking at one of the eyes. He said that this eye that they were examining, it wasn't anything like a human eye, and it didn't even look like some kind of living creature's eye. He said it was more like an optical instrument. He said it had layers, and it looked like some kind of optical device more than it did a real eye. It wasn't like it was living tissue like you would see in a human eye or any organism. He said it was more like an optical device from a camera or something like that. It didn't look living. It looked mechanical. And he said the second thing that he noticed and wrote down, these creatures didn't have sex organs. And that led to him medically beginning to think, there's no way for them to relieve themselves. There are no exterior orifices. If these things are living creatures, all living creatures eat, and all living creatures expel waste. I don't see how they do that, he said. And the next thing, he started looking at the mouth and went, the mouth doesn't look like it's a carnivore, like it would eat like an ape, or was kind of like hominid, but it was nothing like a human being. It looked more like, kind of almost like an insect, he said, in the shape of its head. And that the insect part of it, maybe that's why its eye was so funny, that it was totally different than a human eye. It didn't look like it ate, like it was solid food, or that it might live on fluids or something. But then knowing how a human being expels liquid from its body, how did this creature do that? And he couldn't see any signs of that. And then he said they opened up the thoracic section of the body, and that it had organs and internal components, but nothing like a human being, and not nearly as complex. And that really got his attention right away. You open up a human being, it's just packed with all sorts of things, including the GI tract and the lungs and all that. And there were living things inside, but not what he would have thought of, these creatures weren't as complex as we were. There was just things missing inside of them. It baffled him. They're obviously a living organism, but how does this living organism function? And the next thing he noticed, he said, was its hands. Their hands were, for the size of the body, larger, but very delicate with long fingers, and there was something odd about them. There was like pads on their fingertips. And I said, do you think these things were intelligent? He looked at me kind of stunned, and I said, well, how could they not be? This isn't their world, and they're here. And I hadn't thought about that. I was just overwhelmed by the story. These are extraterrestrials. These are people from another world. And now I'm starting to get overwhelmed by the whole thing. And this was what was disturbing him so bad, this event that happened to him in his past. He said that the next thing he noticed about them was that he didn't see anything else in the room but them. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? And he said, clothing. They were naked, dead bodies, and you didn't see anything that might belong to them in the room. And he said, exactly. There was nothing in the room. And there was this horrible stench, unlike any smell he'd ever smelled before. And that when he started watching their bodies and just looking at them from head to toe, he said they had a very pale complexion, but what was their body, the skin, their covering, it almost had a fabric-like look to it. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, I mean just that. It was obviously their flesh, their body, but it sure didn't look like soft human tissue that is on a human body. This was nothing like anything he'd seen before. It was just like it was fabric. It was almost as if it had a suit on, but that the suit was its flesh at the same time. And he said it also dawned to him when he was sitting there, they got the wrong people here. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, since these things aren't really human and just sort of kind of look like humans, why don't we have zoologists here or anthropologists here or people that understand more life forms than just human beings?
And, George, remember recently I had on Coast the Navy Chief Yeoman Thomas Coleman Shepherd?
Yes.
And he was in Okinawa at the White Beach Naval Base on Thanksgiving night of 1976. That would be 1 year after this conversation between Ronnie Sequoy and the Colonel Flight Surgeon from Ohio. And Thomas Coleman Shepherd described the black and white photographs that he and two other colleagues saw in a classified vault, and the photographs were in files that were stamped MAJIC, which is the classification stamp for Majestic 12 in all the leaked documents that I, Bob, and Ryan Wood and others have seen. Well, in those drawings, he drew for me what he remembered of the photograph, and one of the details were long, thin fingers that had pads on the ends. Now, that is a correlation with this autopsy description. Thomas Coleman Shepherd also said that it was odd that it looked like skin, but the skin, he even used the term, the skin was wrinkled, like you would think of cloth being wrinkled, but he thought they were nude. This idea that we are dealing with entities that were retrieved in the late 1940s from vehicles, aerial vehicles that were described by our own government in a variety of documents as interplanetary, celestial, and finally, enemy weapons system, as they were later on described. And when you realize that you have a body that this flight surgeon, as he's describing to Ronald Sequoy, is seeing skin, quote, that is not organic, and he's seeing eyes that are not organic. They are described as optical instruments, and today we have a word for this. It is called android.
Yes.
With robotic parts. And I want to reinforce another paragraph from what I still think is one of the most important books ever contributed from firsthand military intelligence knowledge, and that is The Day After Roswell, that was first released in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And on pages 45 to 46 is this paragraph, quote, this is Colonel Corso talking about his handling and seeing this material. This is not a second, third-hand remove. This is Corso describing his own experience. Quote, I was most interested in the file descriptions accompanying a two-piece set of dark elliptical eyepieces as thin as skin. The Walter Reed pathologist said they adhered to the lenses of the extraterrestrial creature's eyes and seemed to reflect existing light, even in what looked like complete darkness, so as to illuminate and intensify images in the darkness to allow their wearer to pick out shapes. The reports had said that the pathologist at Walter Reed Hospital, who autopsied one of these creatures, tried to peer through them in the darkness, actually picking it up and looking through it, to watch the one or two army sentries and medical orderlies walking down a corridor adjacent to the pathology lab. These figures were illuminated in a greenish-orange, depending upon how they moved, but the pathologist could see only their outer shape. And when they got close to each other, their shapes blended into a single form, but they could also see the outlines of furniture and the wall and objects on desktop, unquote. George, this is a description of lenses that were looking at the world in infrared.
That's right.
Okay. So what I'm beginning as an investigative reporter to see more clearly, it seems like every day, the more pieces that we have had leaked, or in this case, Colonel Corso wrote this book before he died the next year. Piece after piece, it is coming together like a big puzzle, and we are beginning to realize that another reason why the Truman administration, and I know that the cover-up goes back to the Roosevelt administration, and we've talked about that on Coast before, but the Truman administration had a policy in which they wanted to shoot out of the sky this what they call disc technology, and that their own military began calling enemy weapon systems because down at White Sands Proving Ground at the time, now today White Sands Missile Range, we had the German scientists in Project Paperclip who were bringing German rocket missile research here, mm-hmm. and we were launching them only to find that round objects that were captured on film would appear instantaneously. They didn't see them coming from any place. They would appear instantaneously next to the V-2 rocket launches, and as soon as they appeared with it, what they called the disc technology or peculiar phenomenon, the V-2 rocket would veer off course, and there would be crashes that would, of course, be explained by our government as gyroscopic failures to the local media. Now, when you look back then, and the Truman administration was trying to shoot these down, there is evidence coming from people like Andrew Kistner, who was a state representative in New Mexico, who tried so hard to get to the bottom of what really happened at Roswell, and said that there was retaliation. We were not dealing with an intelligence that was passive and just monitoring. There was retaliation in taking down our electromagnetic grids of power, interrupting a whole variety of things, and there is testimony in the Majestic 12 documents and the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit document that we lost planes, literally planes and pilots, disappeared out of the sky when these craft were around. It wasn't just something, a melt and fire. They just literally disappeared. And these statements are written in the first, what's called the first annual report by Majestic 12 in what we think was 1952. There's an earlier report by the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit in 1947. When FDR was president, his Army Chief of Staff was George Marshall, and who was head of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit and wrote memos to FDR on IPU stationery or memos, was George Marshall discussing the interaction with craft And when we fired artillery in 1942, February, in Los Angeles, in the so-called Battle of Los Angeles, now we have leaked documents that say our government took down or retrieved, whether we shot them or something, we retrieved two craft. Well, all of this then leads to the question, how many bodies and craft did we have before 1947? And was this a shock to this colonel flight surgeon? He had no concept at the time of an android with robotic parts, but the Truman administration might already have known that some or all of the entities that they had gotten in crashes were not technically fully biological. And George, looking back into the 1940s, that fact alone must have been astonishing to the president, to the military people, to the scientists. And one of the most interesting, and when we come back in the second segment and we hear that next audio, I'm going to quote from some of the leaked documents about who the surgeons might have been in that autopsy room. What our own government's documents, more than one, have said in detailed description. And what interests me is there seems to be so many more than one that what was on the table in front of this flight surgeon that sounds so much like the photographs of Thomas Coleman Shepard is different from our government's own descriptions in a training manual that was written by Majestic 12 for very special units to go out and retrieve. The title says, Extraterrestrial Biological Entity Retrievals and Recovery. And when we go into this next segment and we hear more about this flight surgeon and we come back out of it, I'll share some more information from these leaked documents that show that our government has had a great deal of knowledge for more than half a century.
Okay, Lyndon, we also come back. I want to get your gut instinct into Ronald Zicoi and get your views on him, especially after you spent so much time talking to him. Richard C. Hoagland, by the way, just sent me a message, and he had a friend who was an engineer at White Sands and went on to become a leading science fiction writer, G. Harry Stein, and he claims that many of the things you just talked about and attested to at White Sands indeed happened. So there's some more corroboration from just another outside source. Stick with us. Another hour to go of Linda Moulton Howe's special report, and then in the final hour we'll open up the phone lines. In addition to questions, she's asking if any of you have any first-hand or second-hand knowledge. You might want to share it with us or at least get the information to Linda somehow. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, let's review a little bit before we go into the next audio segment, if you would, and then I want to just get your thoughts on Ronald Zicoi.
Well, Ronald Zicoi is fundamentally in all communication with me, has been straightforward, has provided all information that I have asked for. And like so many other people, he has to worry about his life, his business being jeopardized.
Sure.
But he really feels strongly, like Thomas Coleman Shepard and a few others, that this is way past time for the facts and the truth to come out. If our government has a policy of denial, at least people who have some firsthand knowledge, if they will just step up to the plate and talk, and you will hear in the, as we unfold in this hour, his own thoughts about why he contacted me.
Okay, give us a little review and then go right into your next segment, Linda.
And where we have been, this is a discussion between a colonel flight surgeon and his employee, who was a manager of the retired flight surgeon's company in Dayton, Ohio, and the time frame where this series of deep conversations took place over a period of weeks was from Christmas time for about a month. And Ronnie Zicoi was managing a company that this retired flight surgeon was operating in Dayton, Ohio, which is not far from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where this flight surgeon had lived his life, worked, and retired. And we have been hearing how he was jerked out of bed around 2 o'clock in the morning by a phone call from the base, told by a general who came on the phone to get there in 45 minutes. He knew something serious, couldn't believe it when he got there, and there were three generals, and they, without any orientation and no explanation, handed him a clipboard, gave him a pen, and told him to enter a room and to make any notes as a flight surgeon of anything that came to his mind. And that, as he said, was when he walked through a door and his world turned upside down, because what was on the table were two extraterrestrial biological entities that were clearly not human, and he even compared them to being doll-like. And what we are now going to go into is something that may actually have been described, George, in a July 22nd, 1947 Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit summary. This was leaked to Bob and Ryan Wood, who produced the excellent MajesticDocuments.com website.
Right.
You can see this entire Interplanetary Phenomena Unit July 22nd, 1947 summary at www.MajesticDocuments.com. But before we go into this next audio excerpt from Ronald Sukoy, I want to share a paragraph that describes an autopsy that might be the two surgeons at Wright-Patterson that the colonel flight surgeon was observing. And here we go. It says, this is about bodies that were recovered from White Sands at the Trinity site. Dr. Detlef Bronk has been asked to assist in the autopsy of one well-preserved cadaver to be done by Major Charles Ray, REA. From what descriptions the team was able to learn and from photographs taken by intelligence photographers, the occupants appear in most respects human, with some anatomical differences in the head, eyes, hands, and feet. They have a slight build, about 5 feet tall, with grayish-pink skin color. They have no hair on their bodies and are clothed in a tight-fitting flight suit that appears to be fireproof. Some of the bodies looked as if they had been burned on the head and the hands. Their overall stature reminds one of young children. It is believed there were male and female genders present, but that was hard to distinguish. Okay, now we know that the flight surgeon said he could see no sexual organs,
right,
or orifices, and he estimated that they were 4 feet tall, and he compared them to dolls. Because they were so perfect looking. And here we have this issue of this tight-fitting flight suit. Well, that may be the way the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit report described what the flight surgeon said was inorganic skin, a fabric instead of skin, along with those optical eye devices. And in this report, the idea of the android was in detail, but this may be the same autopsy, and that the two doctors doing the work that is being observed by the flight surgeon could very well be Dr. Detlef Bronk, who is on the original Harry S. Truman Majestic 12 list of experts to advise and study and monitor the extraterrestrial situation, and Major Charles Ray. Now, an interesting point is that the colonel flight surgeon told Ronald Sukoy that at one point, perhaps overcome by what he said was a horrible stench in the room and it was warm, that the two doctors doing the autopsy asked to take a break, and everybody took a break, and the flight surgeon could no longer hold back. He vomited. When the general realized that the flight surgeon was really upset and had vomited, here now is what happened next.
All right.
And I said, well, what happened next? And he said, they took me up the hall, and they never take me back. And I said, are you saying you didn't do a good job? And he said, from their perspective, I don't think I did do a good job, that I was the wrong man. And that's when he broke down again, and he said, and I was the wrong man, and why did they do this to me? I'm not a specialist. I'm not a pathologist. I wasn't a real surgeon that did surgery on people. I was just a basic doctor. Why me? They shouldn't have involved this in my life. I shouldn't have been caught up in this. And then to threaten me and tell me I could be court-martialed if I ever told anybody that I could be imprisoned for the rest of my life. That's when I realized he'd been carrying this thing inside of him all these years and replaying this. It went through my head. There's got to be moments that this comes back to him, maybe on a daily basis, that he's been locked in this nightmare.
And you are talking to me on June 27th, 2006, about all of this. Why?
Well, this shook me up, too. And I'm a man of my word. I carried this inside myself for years. And needless to say, you know, every time I would see a movie or something on television or Star Trek or anything, I would relive these moments of discussing these events with this man all through these decades. But I never thought about telling anybody. One, I gave my word, but two, who would you tell it to? And I didn't want to be thought of as being crazy, because back in those times, that many years ago, if anybody said they believed in aliens or whatever, you'd be laughed at. There wasn't the kind of revelations that have come out over the last 30 years. But over the course of time, I began to see things on television and hearing events, and quite frankly, you. The number of times that I've heard you on radio giving very detailed interviews with people and uncovering facts, and it would be like pieces of a puzzle. And one day, I had this thought in my head that this whole issue is like this gigantic, huge puzzle the size of a basketball court or something with all these pieces. It's so complex, and you got to turn over all the pieces to see the whole picture of what this whole thing is, that this is a gigantic thing to comprehend. And I know one little piece of the puzzle, that's all. But it's one little piece that somebody ought to come forward, because over the course of time, as I would hear things about this on these talk radio programs that I like to listen to, I used to get angry of, why don't these people come forward? These people that went through this and knew things about this. And then one day it just dawned on me, well, you know something about this, and you haven't come forward. And so that disturbed me for some time, and I thought about that. But how do I do this, and who would listen to me? And I just heard about it, and I didn't see it myself. And then one day I said, I've been to your webpage before, and I went back, but I'd never even looked at it in terms of contacting you. I just would look to see what was there at Earth Files. I decided to go back again. I looked it over, and then that's when I saw the thing about how to contact you. And I swallowed hard. And then I didn't do it. I backed out, and I thought about it for a day, and I went back, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And that's when I entered the message in to contact you. And then a couple weeks went by, and I said, well, I did it. But she isn't going to contact me back. And the very day that I said she isn't going to contact me back, there was an email from you. These bodies, they came from somewhere. That means that there were people that handled them. They were transported across the United States. There were people involved. They came to Wright-Patterson, and if they were there at Wright-Patterson, that means people knew about it. In that building when this autopsy was going on with this gentleman, there had to be, just in that area, by the conversation I had with him, I counted up in my head, there had to be a dozen people right there. And then those people had other people around them, the security, the doctors, the generals, their support staff. How many people know about this? And if there are that many people involved, how can it be that so many people don't come forward? And then I realized, when I think about that, I'm looking at this dynamic human being, college educated, a doctor, a colonel in the Air Force, that this shattered his life, and that he was afraid. He was afraid by the threats they made against him. If you could intimidate such a dynamic individual that's a colonel in the military, that he's terrified that they'll ruin his life, that they'll allow to put him in a room someplace for the rest of his life and he'll never get out, if he would ever convey what he saw or heard to anybody else, what did they do to lesser people?
Did they threaten him with anything else besides court-martial and being drummed out of the military?
Yes.